Tonight on Arena, we're off to Paris for a virtual tour of the Louvre, and Neil Burke puts us in a permanent queue in his debut novel, Line. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Max Richter is one of the most prodigious and musically diverse composers of the 21st century, with work ranging from orchestral compositions, scoring music for film and television, theatre works, ballets and solo albums. His composition for film and television just in the last few years have included Charlie Brooker's Black Mirror, Mary Queen of Scots starring Saoirse Ronan and Margot Robbie, and Ad Astra with Brad Pitt. This month, he released his latest album, Voices 2, a follow-up to his Voices album, written as a musical accompaniment to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. I'll be speaking with Max Richter very shortly. But first of all, let's have a piece of music from the first album in this pair. This is All Human Beings 2.
Everyone is entitled to all the rights and freedoms set forth in this declaration, without distinction of any kind, such as race, color, sex, language, religion, political or other opinion, national or social origin, property, birth, or other status. Furthermore, no distinction shall be made on the basis of the country to which a person belongs.
And that was All Human Beings 2, featuring texts from Articles 1 and 2 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, read by the American actor Kiki Layne, and was taken from the album Voices, with music by Max Richter. That album was released last year. Voices 2 is gearing up for release, and delighted to have Max Richter join us on the programme this evening. A decade in the making for these two albums for you, Max. Where did the idea first come about of writing music that might be paired with, you know, that wonderful aspirational text of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights?
Well, I guess the idea really comes from my sense that we were kind of losing our way, and we were forgetting those wonderful words. You know, politics and the way the world's been going over the last few years, I felt like history was going into reverse, and instead of getting closer to those principles, we were kind of losing sight of them or forgetting them. So, we wanted to make a piece where we could, you know, reconnect with the inspiration and, the kind of that extraordinary achievement of that text.
We just heard the American actor there, Kiki Layne, who's part of the project. How did that involvement come about?
I wanted to have a voice reading the text that was a young voice. Right at the beginning of the record, you actually hear the recording of Eleanor Roosevelt, who was involved and, really instrumental in getting the text written, recorded in 1949. For the articles themselves, I wanted somebody who's about, you know, about now and about the future, because the text really is about, you know, potential for the future. And so Kiki's voice, I heard Kiki's work in If Beale Street Could Talk, a beautiful film, a couple of years ago, and I just fell in love with her voice, and I thought, that would be a great voice for this.
Yeah, it really suits the tone of particularly those early articles. And I did use the word aspirational. Are we sadly in a world where it is still aspirational? Or how close are we to achieving the sort of ideals that the Declaration of Human Rights states?
Well, I think it's very paradoxical, isn't it? I mean, you know, as a species, you know, we as a society, we've managed to come up with these extraordinary, inspirational texts, and yet we completely fail to live up to them. So, I mean, it's just, I guess my sort of take on this is that, you know, we need to, you know, fail better. As Beckett said, we need to keep trying, and it's just good to be reminded of what's possible, because the Declaration is this wonderful kind of recipe for a better world.
You mentioned Eleanor Roosevelt there, and her voice does feature, as you say, in the preamble to the in the reading of the Declaration of Human Rights as part of your piece. How involved was she in, you know, moving things forward in terms of human rights as far back as 1940, a very different America? Well,
yeah, well, she was an extraordinarily she was kind of really a powerful personality, somebody who really connected people, somebody who was very driven by her sense of justice and fairness. You know, she was really in the middle of the sort of racial justice conversations of the time, and was really a catalyst who drove this whole thing through the UN. She took it on as a kind of a personal mission.
Yeah, so I suppose it's only right that you should have given her the preamble then. Or where did you get this recording? Obviously, it was there. Had this existed previously?
Yeah, well, I came across it just doing my research on the UN, various resources that the UN has about the Declaration, and there was this amazing recording of her reading the preamble, and I just thought, well, it's too good, you know, too good to not use it. I mean, it's amazing. It's like a window back into another time.
Absolutely. Let's have a listen.
I'm going to read you the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The preamble. Whereas recognition of the inherent dignity and of the equal and inalienable rights of all members of the human family is the foundation of freedom, justice, and peace in the world. Now, therefore, the General Assembly proclaims this Universal Declaration of Human Rights as a common standard of achievement for all peoples and all nations, to the end that every individual and every organ of society, keeping this declaration constantly in mind, shall strive by teaching and education to promote respect for these rights and freedoms, and by progressive measures, national and international, to secure their universal and effective recognition and observance.
The voice of Eleanor Roosevelt there, as heard in Max Richter's piece Voices. And that Voices 1 and 2 is what we're talking about this evening, Max. Voices you gave to us last year, and Voices 2 then is, in some ways for me, it's like a companion piece. So can I just stick with Voices 1 for the time being? Because there's another very interesting aspect. We've heard Eleanor Roosevelt, that's a name we'll know. Kiki Lane's a name that people will know as well. But one of the things that you did in Voices that I thought was really noteworthy was you went around and got at least, I don't know how many voices, but 70 languages, I think, are represented across the piece as you realised it. How did you find those voices? What were you looking for in giving those voices a chance to be heard?
Well, what I wanted to do is I wanted to kind of embed the kind of democratic principle and the community principle that the Declaration is all about. I wanted to embed that into the musical work itself. So I just asked people on social media, please, you know, read some of this text in your native language, something that means to you, something to you specially. And people just sent them in, you know. So I had all these hundreds of texts coming in, very beautiful to hear all these voices, people sharing their, you know, their own readings. And I just, I just kind of made this sort of landscape of voices that the music then flows through.
Yeah, and I guess that is what a composer does in some ways, isn't it? You take bits and pieces and compose them. You put them together into some kind of coherent whole.
Exactly.
Let's have a listen to then Origins Part 1, which features many of those voices in various languages.
Ja vapautta ilman minkäänlaista rotuun, Gladys.
And that's just a flavour of Origins, part one, from Max Richter's composition, Voices, which is a realisation in some ways of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Several different voices, public voices, if you like, democratic but journalism and composition in some ways involved in that, Max. But it was on December the 10th, to coincide with World Human Rights Day, Voices was broadcast in its entirety across 30 international radio stations in Europe, in America, in Australia, and including our own RTE Lyric FM here in Ireland. Mm. Now, you organised this with your creative partner, Yulia Maher. Yulia has a particular experience in terms of fights for human rights.
Yes, I mean, the story of her family, like so many families from Central Europe in the last century, you know, is the story of having to leave your home unwillingly, being forced to, relocate and change countries, and that was a big part of her experience, her mother's experience, her grandmother's experience. Mm. And of course, it was a very common experience, is a very common experience in Europe even today, and all over the world. So, that was her own sort of window into the material. And Yulia's actually made a series of films to accompany the music. We see the project very much as a kind of audiovisual piece. And the whole film side of it is still developing as well.
How important for you then as a composer is that link between, I suppose, the political statement and the musical statement?
Well, I think it's, speaking just personally for me, I see creativity as a sort of, in a way, inevitably having a kind of an activist dimension. We make things out of our experience in the world, out of our experience of being alive, and about our experience of being alive. That's what creativity is. We respond to things and then we tell stories and we talk about them. And I just see that as kind of very natural, really.
I'll finish up with a piece from Voices 2. And you've designed, I think, Voices 2, you've referred to it as a, quote, thinking complement to the first album. So we heard the text, we hear the text in various forms in the first album. Yeah. What do we get then in the second album, and what is your hope from it?
Well, for me, Voices 2 is really a space to dream into the future. Voices 1 is all about the declaration, the world we've made up to this point, and a place to kind of reflect on those texts. And Voices 2 is a space to, dream into the future dream a better world into existence.
Well, I'll give our listeners a chance to have a couple of minutes of dreaming just now. But lovely to speak with you this evening, Max, and thanks for sharing your thoughts with us.
Thank you so much. Thanks.
That's Max Richter. And let's listen to then Prelude 2 from Voices 2. Section from Prelude 2, taken from Voices 2, new album from British composer Max Richter, who was speaking with us earlier there. And that album will be released this Friday, April the 9th. You're listening to Wednesday Night's Arena. Now, remember when the Carters, Jay-Z and Beyoncé got their own private tour of the Louvre? They didn't just look at the artworks. While they were there, they filmed the video for this song. Check. There you go, the Carters with Ape Shit, and that video for the video for that particular song made in the Louvre in Paris. And now, courtesy of the French nation, we can all be the Carters. We are invited to visit the Louvre from home. The largest art gallery in the world, which was once the home to the French kings, has now opened its collection covering 10,000 years of history to the people of the world. All you need to do is to log on to louvre.fr.en /en/online tours. I'll give that web address out again before the end of the item, and we'll also tweet it. But on Arena, we've asked Jess Fahey to take the tour for us, and she joins me now. I love that song that was that had its video made in the Louvre itself. But the director of the Musée du Louvre, Jean-Luc Martinez, has said that for the first time, anyone can access the entire collection of works from a computer or smartphone for free, whether they are on display in the museum, on loan, even long-term, or in storage. There's a lot of material to get through here in terms of the number of works, apart from anything else, Jess.
Yes, it's an extraordinary number of works. And of course, that's going to make it a little bit difficult if you wanted to try and see everything. But they've really put, I think, a lot of work into making it accessible as possible, making it as user-friendly as possible, even if you're on your phone, so that you can find what you're looking for in a variety of different ways. And the sort of idea of opening it up in this way, you know, for us art historians, we're, of course, over the moon. But it also follows on from, weirdly enough, the original sort of idea from the French Revolution of taking, you know, the collection away from the church and the monarchy and giving it to the people. So this is like our modern version of that, I suppose.
480,000 artworks of art, 10,000 years of history. And they've divided that up into eight curatorial sections. But let's talk about maybe, you know, how you might even approach the website, which could be daunting. At least you're at home, so you can make a fool of yourself by yourself if you're getting lost. First of all, we go on to the homepage, and language is an important detail here. You can get it in several languages.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, the thing about something like this is that the expectation would be that it would just be in the, you know, home language, if you like. But the fact that they have expanded that to make it, again, much more accessible is important. So from the homepage, you can, you know, first of all, choose your language, and then you have a few options as to what you might want to do. So how you're going to visit it. So you can choose from the palace, the gardens, or the collection. And the palace really just is more a sort of quick way to get into the highlight tour, pretty much. And there's a few other things on that page as well. So it might suggest a theme to you of looking, say, at just Islamic art. So it brings you that way. The gardens is more about actually being outside in the garden and what cafes open and what time and those kind of things. So it's a bit more practical. But the one that's really special is the collections. So this is where you have, again, many options of how you're going to navigate it. The one I enjoyed the most was the interactive map, because I know this map from having been there, and it's usually just paper and it's usually quite complicated. And even if you have it in front of you, because of the vastness of the museum, you still feel like you're forever turning it this way and that way and trying to navigate it. So this means now you have it on your phone if you're there, or if you're at home, you can do it from home. And you just, you know, get your mouse and hover over any area and you can click on any of the rooms, and then it will show you a general photograph of the room. And then underneath it has all of the paintings, say, or sculpture or objects that are in that room. Each of them you can then click on and you get a fantastic high resolution image. This is the thing that us art historians and teachers are very excited about.
Some of the material that I came across is just like literally wandering around. The level of detail is quite extraordinary indeed. And as you say, that interactive map, very much part of it. But I suppose there's a highlights tour. And the first thing I did when I went onto the website today, I opened up the homepage, and immediately, it's the reason most people who are going doing the French or the Paris tour to go to the Louvre, they want to see the Mona Lisa. It came there. Yeah. It came up on the practically immediately in front of me. You know, and the Mona Lisa, Leonardo da Vinci, obviously. And as we're speaking now, our own colleague Janice will be retweeting the image from the Louvre Twitter account. So we'll be seeing on our page, which is at RTE Arena, we'll be retweeting the images from the Louvre Twitter account Twitter account itself. So let's start with when we go into Mona Lisa. Give us a sense of the sort of detail that we get when we go on the tour, or when we look at this painting, Jess.
Yeah, so I think one of the things that people often say about the Mona Lisa when they see it in person is how small it is and how they can't get anywhere near it. So this is the complete opposite experience to that, because you get to go in, not just, you know, zoom in on the surface details of the varnishes and a paint that's, you know, that we can see with the naked eye, but actually you can go in and look at it through infrared, through x-ray, through ultraviolet. So you can see all the underdrawings, all of these things. So from that perspective, it's extraordinary. But even just when you get to looking close at the surface, you can see, you know, elements of the age of it and the kind of damage and things over the years, which the Louvre is actually quite well known for preserving the history of the object rather than try to restore it back to what they imagine it would have originally looked like, which say the National Gallery in London might be more inclined to do. So you really get to see that. And then you also get to examine the tiniest little areas in this close detail to really see the extraordinary technique of Leonardo. And one of the things that he's famed for is atmospheric perspective. So the ability to paint a landscape that looks like it is very naturalistic, very believable. And that's because it fades as it goes off into the distance, and it gets colder in color as it goes off into the distance. So you get to examine exactly where he starts to shift and change that, which is something not that easy to see if you're looking at the overall work. So,
the sort of guidance that you're given on that, though, is quite extraordinary, both in terms of short videos and texts that can crop up at the side. And of course, it's the stories around the paintings as much as anything else that I think are of interest to people. What do we get around explaining the famous smile of the Mona Lisa? How is that given to us?
So the one of the ideas of putting together this online collection was each curator from each department would then have this role of giving us this information. So it's, you know, the top notch sort of people writing this. So essentially what we're looking at is a technique called sfumato, which just in Italian kind of translates to smoky. And it's where you have a very subtle graduation of tone so that it looks like a kind of smoky eye, if we were thinking about it in today's makeup. And it means that our eye jumps about when we look at it. So it's not giving us just one kind of complete perfect view. Instead, we see more closely to how we naturally see. So it's a kind of optic way of painting. So we think her smile flickers, essentially, because it does, our eyes don't settle because of this soft graduation of tone. So they, you know, very cleverly have an option where you click on observe, and then it sections out parts of the painting that you can click on. And then it gives you these little extra bits of information. And then that little video you mentioned as well comes in the understand section, where it also talks about things like how Duchamp, Marcel Duchamp in the 20th century, kind of poked fun at this painting. And, you know, the sort of fame of it and the kind of idea of how the fame of a painting can then affect how it influences art later on.
Yeah, well, the Marcel Duchamp web title is worth repeating. He puts a moustache on her face, effectively, and
on a postcard,
kind of makes fun of the painting, as you say. But then he entitles the painting El H O O Cool. So the French students among us might be able to, when you read that out, it becomes Elle a chaud au cul. I know that Elle a chaud means she has something warm. What does au cul mean, Jess?
Well, it can mean end, or can mean bottom. So there's also a coarser word that it could mean, but essentially he's, you know, poking fun at the fact it's the one part of her we can't see. But he's guaranteeing us that that's the case.
Yeah, she has a hot bottom, we can say, I think, without being. But it is that kind of looking at how the painting itself, there was also another section in there where it actually, it moves into loads of different versions, if you like, are loads of different, I suppose, answers or responses to the original Da Vinci painting
dialogues
as well.
So that was one of the things that I was surprised about, that they, you know, took it to you know, what would be much more common in a kind of deeper delve into the history of a painting to then sort of compare it to what comes next. So it shows you that their ambition with what they're going to do with the collection overall is really quite exciting, because if they're not just talking about the one object they have, but they're relating it to objects and collections around the world, it really gives a wonderfully comprehensive view of that object. So the Louvre will be almost, you know, a one-stop shop to get really detailed art historical research on these objects and more.
And a few stories around, particularly around the Mona Lisa, wasn't there the famous theft in the early 20th century?
Yeah, arguably that's why this painting is so famous. And I know that's quite a controversial thing to say, but it really wasn't the most famous painting in the world until it was stolen in the 19-teens. And this was because, you know, it was like a kind of Lindbergh baby sort of situation. It was all over all the papers and everyone was, you know, trying to find it. And there was rewards offered and all this kind of craziness around it. It turned out in the end, it was this Italian man who I think had been staff, and he believed that it needed to be brought back to Italy. So he smuggled it back to Italy. And then they said, well, no, we don't actually want you to smuggle it back for us. And it was sent then back to the Louvre. But the Louvre has a long history of owning works that were stolen. So there was about 20,000 works stolen by Napoleon that he then brought to the Louvre. So it's not as if, you know, their hands are clean entirely. But in the case of the Mona Lisa, it went from the artist to the French state quite directly, because Leonardo worked for Francis the First.
Right, okay. So nobody's really arguing about whether it's owned by France or not, but there could be arguments about other paintings, I guess. Now, let's put up, exactly. We're going to tweet now on at RTE Arena a picture of the Venus de Milo. I want to talk about this piece of sculpture, first of all, but it links us into Louvre Kids, which is another section of the website. What's on offer there?
It's actually really fun stuff. So a lot of little animations. So, for example, for the Venus de Milo, it shows you a little scene from 1820 when this man, you know, this Greek man is on the island of Milos looking for just stone to use to build a wall. And he discovers this underground kind of open space that has this sculpture in it. And it just so happens that there's this French antiquarian there at the same time, and he buys it off him straight away and then brings it back to France. So it gives a kind of fun, sort of cutesy sort of way of showing the story, but actually very informative and doesn't over-exaggerate too much or anything like that. But the general sort of program for kids, I think, is quite good too, and it's almost like kind of little ways of linking them in and bringing them in and entertaining them. But it is interesting to think about something like this being, you know, that sort of famous and that young children that young get to learn about it. You know, it's used in The Simpsons, for example. You know, Homer finds a sweet that is like I can't remember the name of the sweet, but it looks like the Venus de Milo. So those kind of cultural references, learning them early in a fun way like that, I think is great.
Yeah, and as you say, just a way of opening up the works of art to maybe younger viewers and listeners who you just want to get them, have them exposed to them as much as anything else. Now, you chose a specific sculpture for us from Desiderio da Settignano, if I'm saying his name correctly, a relief profile bust of Julius Caesar. Just tell me, first of all, how you got to this, because I think on my initial search, I came across over 35,000 pieces of sculpture that I could look at. I thought, how do I get down to getting just the one I want?
Yeah, so this is the thing. It works in various different ways, as I say. So you can just, you know, use the interactive map to drop in and just find something surprising. But if, say, for example, you're a researcher and you want to look at specific things, you can, in fact, go in and you can select an explore menu, which either suggests the subject, so you can look at various things like just textiles or just jewellery or just sculpture, and then inside of that you can narrow the parameters of your search. So for example, for me, I'm doing a bit of research on 15th century Italian sculpture at the moment, so I just put in Italy as the country of origin, time period 1400 to 1500. That you could just select marble if you wanted. You could search the name of the artist if you knew you just wanted to look at their work. But it means that now you can have all of the selections, you know, that you're interested in comparing, and they'll come up usually on a page of about 24, and you can very quickly look through them, but the images are so good. Whereas prior to this, you know, the online catalogue, and it's the same for most museums, don't have images for everything. So Desiderio da Settignano is an unusual and not very well known artist, so he would not often be the artist chosen to have his work digitalized and a photograph taken and put online. So the fact that you now can even find lesser known artists and have this great catalogue entry with all the details you could possibly want in terms of provenance, in terms of bibliography, exhibition history, all of these things, and this image that you can zoom in on in great close detail. So it's just like, you know.
Yeah, I'm just looking at it now on our own Twitter page at RTE Arena. We've retweeted the image from the Louvre's Twitter page, so we can see that Julius Caesar head there, and we certainly get that profile bust of Julius Caesar. Mm-hmm. We get a sense of what a Roman nose is for sure.
Absolutely, yes, yeah. And of course, Desiderio da Settignano is in the Renaissance, so he's sort of using classical antiquity like examples to copy what Julius Caesar may have looked like. But this is from around 1460, and the idea of doing something this way, like almost like a sort of antiquarian's approach, wouldn't have been that typical. And actually, the lifelike quality, almost the sort of aged kind of papery looking skin here, is far beyond the naturalism of many other sculptors of this period. It's only really that he died very young that people don't know that much about him. He has an association with Donatello, and sometimes there is a confusion over which pieces might have been by the more famous artist or the lesser known. But it gives us this wonderful insight into this very particular moment of an adoration of the Roman past by the Renaissance artists.
And how limited then, in overall terms, Jess, is if you go as a virtual visitor onto the website, can you see everything? Can you go your own way, or are there just a few selected tours that you're brought on?
So at the moment, there are a few selected tours. So say, for example, if you wanted to use the virtual tours. So this is something that I've been doing a lot since the lockdown, and, you know, using virtual tours online to bring people, to make them feel like they're going away for an hour to look at a collection. And some are better than others. So, for example, the Vatican Museum one is extraordinary. You can look at the Sistine Chapel ceiling, and it's you can use like high definition glasses and things if you have them to kind of feel like you're really there. In the case here, they've kind of focused in a little bit more on exhibitions, which again is a good idea, because if the collection and the permanent collection is pretty much always exhibited the same way, which it is in the Louvre, you can just go and see it, whereas exhibitions are temporary, so you won't get to see it again. So they've made these little kind of 360 views of the exhibition space that you can turn around, and then you can select individual objects to look at. And one of the ones that they have up, which I thought was really interesting, was founding myths from Hercules to Darth Vader. Again, you get a sense of them trying to bring in a new audience and perhaps a younger audience. But it's a really clever one, because they show you, you know, the relationship between Greek vases and, you know, neoclassical paintings, and then how, you know, film and cinema use these same types of tropes, these same types of images, and it's really clever.
One of the things that happened during lockdown, you know, where people were recreating famous works of art, maybe using socks or bits of clothing at home, all of that type of thing. I wanted to finish up, maybe it's not quite the same thing, but in some ways it relates to that. This is a piece called The Seasons, or The Four Seasons, from Giuseppe Arcimboldo. Explain what the work is. We'll tweet it as we're talking about it. Explain at RTE Arena. Explain what that work is and how this image of the human face is made up.
Yeah, so I think the thing that most people are so surprised about in relation to Arcimboldo is that these are from the 16th century, because they feel like they should be surrealist works. And in fact, Salvador Dali was very much inspired by these works, so no surprise there. So basically, it's kind of a trompe l'oeil, a trick of the eye, where you first think you're just looking at a face, and then as you get closer, you realise that that face is entirely made up of fruit and vegetables. And in this case, place here, fruit and vegetables that come out in the summer. So this is part of a group of the Four Seasons, and this was commissioned directly from the artist and meant as a series that would stay together. In fact, it was kind of copied off an earlier commission that the artist had. So it was a famous series in his own lifetime, and this is the second version. So when you look closely, you can see that actually what you think is his mouth is really a pea pod, and there's cherries for his lips. Weirdly, the closer you get to it, the more freaky and sort of bizarre it is, and the more unsettling. In other instances, he also used books to make faces of, you know, the librarian, or fish to make the face of the fish seller, or, you know, so it relates to the person's profession. But in this case, it's the seasons. So yeah, they're just so much fun to look at. And now we have these really high quality images. So it means that you can see what you need to see, which is the weird detail of how, you know, his earlobes actually a garlic clove, you know, these kind of things. But yeah, they're creepy, weird and fun, I think. Yeah.
Well, listen, it's a great way to visit the Louvre. And if we ever do get to a point again when we can actually go to Paris and visit the museum itself, obviously you can bring your smartphone with you and have all of this with you in your pocket. But in the meantime, you can just visit from home, and you don't have to go to it all, which is, even I was thinking, Jess, that it would be an interesting way to plan your visit if you did get a chance to go take a look at the stuff online first of all. Say, yeah, I'm going there, there and there, because you can't do the whole thing in one day. You wreck your head doing that type of thing.
And you get very sore feet and a very sore back very quickly because you're walking really slowly as well. So it's a brilliant idea to do that. So you could absolutely plan it all out in advance and, you know what your route's going to be. Or in fact, as we said before, they give you some routes if you want to just say follow Beyonce, for example.
Yeah, you can see the origins of that video, I suppose, is part of the fun there. Jess, lovely to speak with you as always, and thanks for that evening. Jessica Fahey there telling us about the virtual at the Louvre at home and virtual tour. It's available on, let me give you that website again, louvre.fr/en/online-tours, and maybe we'll retweet that particular website so that it's there on our own Twitter page at RTE Arena, louvre.fr/en/online-tours. In Neil Burke's debut novel, Line, a huge mass of people live for years, generations even, in an enormous queue that spans hundreds, possibly thousands of miles. Theirs is a completely controlled existence ruled by fear. Although set in a dystopian future, the concerns of the novel are very much current. Free market capitalism, surveillance capitalism, data mining, property speculation and the migrant crisis. Neil Burke joins me now from London. None of us like a queue, that's for sure, Neil. But Line really does take this to quite an extreme. It was a queue that inspired you, in fact, or was the initial inspiration for the novel?
There was a Ray Bradbury kind of writing quote, and he said, "Oh, if you're looking for something to write about, just, you know, come up with a list of 10 things you hate and like tear them down." And when I came up with my list, I think queuing was at the top of them. I just can't stand it. So it was kind of a thought experiment to see what would be the longest conceivable queue that would get me to stand in it, and, you know, why would it keep me there? And it kind of went on from there, I suppose.
Yeah, because I don't know if you heard or you could hear the programme from London. We were talking earlier about the Louvre and, in fact, about the Mona Lisa. Now, if you ever went to the Louvre, you have to queue quite a long time to get to see the Mona Lisa. It was a trip to Venice that was a queue in Venice that was the beginnings of this novel.
Well, probably one of many, yeah. But there was we're queuing for the Doge's Palace, and, like, it's a key tourist attraction, so unsurprisingly there was a very big queue, and it was just like, oh, I just can't be bothered, I'm on holidays, like, I'd rather sit down and have a coffee and watch people in the queue. I'm sure it's nice in there, but, like, it's almost as if you felt you had to go stand in the queue for 4 hours because it was something on the holiday list that you had to take off.
Right, you just didn't want that. Well, you've taken your revenge on your poor characters in this novel then by having them queue for the, well, we won't go too far into how much and how long they're queuing. But anyway, let's talk about Willard and Nyla in particular, have been in the line their whole lives. Tell us a bit about them and who they are and the life that they've spent in this line of the novel's title.
Yeah, I guess to some degree they're an every man and every woman. And they're kind of beholden to keep their place in the queue by tradition, because their place has been given to them by their parents and their parents before their parents. And it's just not kind of socially acceptable to renege your place because you can't be bothered waiting, because you carry the weight of tradition and history kind of on your back. And they've all been in the queue so long they've forgotten what's at the top of it. It's kind of turned into a myth about, you know, what's at the top. But they know it must be pretty good, because why else would they be there so long?
And skipping the queue is not a good idea.
No, that's the central tenet, thou shalt not skip the queue. Because there needs to be some mechanism to keep order in what could very easily, as anyone who stood in a kind of ramshackle queue knows, could descend into disorder if someone starts skipping ahead. I think there's a sense that, you know, if you think you're playing by the rules in a queue, but someone else then isn't, that causes great umbrage, I think.
Yeah, but what you do to those who choose to skip the queue, as the author of this book, is pretty nasty stuff. the dripping red catastrophe. You might explain.
Yeah. So if you're caught skipping the queue, you kind of go through a kind of ritualized slaying, where as everyone kind of passes you on the line, they take it in turns to take like a strip of your skin off. And when I was doing my research, actually, I found out there was a Chinese punishment called a ling qi, maybe, I might have the name wrong, which was a kind of a similar social punishment. And the idea was that no one person was responsible. So if everyone inflicts the wound, then no one person is responsible for killing the perpetrator, and therefore the kind of guilt is shared across the community. And so it's a kind of similar sense of ritual shared out punishment to keep a sense of order in the line.
Now, there are a few parallels that struck me. I know that the author Ronan Hessian described Line, your novel, as the grapes of wrath for the digital age.
Yeah.
You know, and there is that sense of it in some ways, not quite going across the Dust Bowl, but this big, you know, this big mass movement of people, wherever they're going and wherever they're coming from, there is a sense of that period. Are you making some kind of parallels there, or is it just history repeating itself in terms of economics?
It's probably history repeating itself. Like, obviously, I am aware of Steinbeck, but I think maybe, you know, the plight of, you know, the disenfranchised working people probably doesn't change that much from generation to generation. The Dust Bowl was quite extreme, but, you know, the idea that there's a large section of people who are kind of forgotten about and forced to traipse around, you know, trying to scrape a living together, probably, you know, that probably doesn't change that much, I suppose.
And the other, I mean, that imagery is there in the book, or certainly was there in the book for me. The other imagery that is there, I think, undoubtedly, is that of refugee camps. Were they on your mind in any way when you were writing the novel?
Yeah, because it took me a long time to write the novel. It probably took about 5 years. And as I was writing it, you know, things on the news were kind of filtering into me and then kind of obliquely filtering into the novel. So, you know, you had the Syrian refugee crisis, and then you had everything with, you know, the elections and Brexit and Facebook and data, and all that was kind of, you know, it was kind of filtering in through me and kind of in through my ears and kind of drifting down through my fingers and working its way into the novel almost unbeknownst to me, I suppose.
And you have a background in economics. You studied economics for a period of time, Neil. How do you think that has fed into the book? Because particularly in the latter part of the book, I don't want to give too much away in terms of plot, but the kind of ideas that you're discussing, it really is taking free market capitalism and it goes into a crazy, crazy place. What were you looking at there?
I was trying to write, I suppose, instead of sci-fi, like economics fi, like economics gone mad. Kind of, you know, what Jonathan Swift did with The Modest Proposal. He kind of took a utilitarian premise and he kind of extrapolated it out to its absurd degree. And I was trying to do something similar, because when I studied economics, there was a rule or a saying that they had, ceteris paribus, which was all else being equal. So, you know, you look at a demand curve or supply curve and it would say ceteris paribus, this will happen. But of course, there is no ceteris paribus because everything isn't always equal. And basically, ceteris paribus was we don't really know. And it kind of struck me that economics was parading itself as a empirical science, but it was kind of made up. And I was like, sure, if they can make it up, I can make it up. So I suppose that's what I was trying to do, invent my own kind of take on economics.
But like things do get to a ridiculous stage or state, I suppose, in terms of where our two characters, Willard and Nyla, and others from the queue and the line, they find themselves in a world that has literally been turned upside down. But to what extent do you think, you know, you push free market capitalism to the very limits in terms of the society that exists in the line? Is that the direct, in truth, do you feel that is the direction that in some ways Western society is heading?
Well, it's obviously an absurd exaggeration. But I think we've seen that if markets are just allowed solely to regulate themselves and no one at any point steps in for anything, like things don't end very well. We've seen that with the 2008 financial crash, and we're seeing it with the environment. So I think, again, it was kind of a thought experiment. And yeah, I've pushed it to like a fairly absurd place. But, you know, if we just leave things totally to themselves and let the market sort it out, then where will we end up?
In fact, you know, I think you at the time you were writing Line, you were reading 23 Things They Don't Tell You About Capitalism. This is the Ha Jun Chang. And I suppose one of the things that is within that book is this idea that there is no such thing, in fact, as a free market. You can't. It always has to be interfered with.
Yeah. That was his point. And he was like, look, if you're advocating for a free market, you're deluding yourself, because a free market means you have to allow slavery, child labor, like everything. The minute you make any kind of regulation, the market is regulated. So when you're advocating for a free market, what a lot of people are really advocating for is something regulated in their favor.
Yeah.
And he pokes a lot of holes in that. He doesn't throw capitalism out with the bathwater and say, get rid of it totally. But I think he asks legitimate questions. I suppose maybe I was quite stirred by that kind of, the way he pointed it out was very clear, it was very obvious. I was surprised, I'd never considered it before.
And in some ways then, are you trying to give us a fictional version of that? Is that what the line in ultimately is about?
I think economics is definitely at the heart of it. Economics kind of is often accepted as, you know, an empirical science that can make accurate predictions. And I don't think it works like that. And I think if we put too much credence into economics as as something as infallible as physics and the laws of gravity, then I think we're setting ourselves up for problems. So I think we should tweak its nose from time to time.
Right, and that's what you're doing in the novel. And the poetry was also there in your background. You had great success with an initial story which was shortlisted for the Costa Short Story Award, and then Real Problems getting published after that. Was poetry did you go off on a side trip towards poetry and then eventually come back to the novel, or what way did that work, Neil?
No, I still write poetry. I kind of write them side by side. I have something coming out, a choose your own poetry adventure coming out in 2022. Because poetry suits me in some ways, because I can write at least a draft of a poem in a relatively short space of time, whereas a novel, you know, it takes years. But the short story, that was the second thing I ever wrote. I got shortlisted for the Costa Short Story Award, and I was like, oh, geez, this writing lark is easy. And I didn't see another thing published for about 3 years, so kind of brought me back down to earth, which was no bad thing.
Yeah, well, the novel is there now, and thanks for speaking to us about it this evening, Neil. That's Neil Burke there, and Neil speaking to us about his novel Line, which is published by Tramp Press. And that is our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Damien Chanel was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme was produced by Olin McGowan. I will talk to you tomorrow night once again, 7 o'clock here on RTE Radio.